Welcome back to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Barb McQuaid, Kimberly Atkins Store, Jill Wine Banks, and me, Joyce Vance. If Santa didn't leave you everything you wanted under the tree, you can still get your favorite Sisters-in-Law merch. We've restocked everything in the store just in time for the new year. You can find it all at politicon.com/merch and head into 2025 with your new favorite t-shirt, sweatshirt, or mug in hand. But now let's get on to the show, where we'll discuss the release of the Matt Gaetz report, the Senate report on ethics in the judiciary, which included, surprise, surprise, new disclosures about trips Justice Clarence Thomas took but didn't disclose, and President Biden's veto of a bill that would have created new judicial appointments just in time for Donald Trump to fill some of them. It's a full show. We racked our brains trying to come up with upbeat topics for this week, but the news gods refused to help out. So it is what it is. But I thought before we headed into the serious stuff, I might ask my sisters how their holidays are going. That has to be good news, right? And Barb, I know yours is because I've seen some of the pictures. You've been out on the ski slopes. What's going on, girlfriend?
Having a great holiday. Got to, you know, all four kids were home for some portion of it. Just wonderful to be with family. All good stuff. And of course, Joyce, the countdown begins for the ReliaQuest Bowl between Michigan and Alabama on New Year's Eve. Game on, sister. I've put up a crazy Michigan hat for Joyce to wear when the Wolverines vanquish her Crimson Tide.
Roll Tide, baby. You've got a darling little knit Alabama hat winging its way to you, courtesy, I hope, of the U.S. Postal Service right now. You know, Jill, I know you are not probably looking forward to the bowl games, although I'm sure you'll enjoy Barb and me going at it, you know, like we always do in these games. How's your holiday been? Have you made latkes, by the way?
I have not made latkes because I've never made them very well. I do have a friend in Brooklyn who he makes the best. They're really, really good. But I'm not getting them this year. I did have a wonderful holiday season with almost as many parties, maybe as many parties as before COVID. This is the first year where I've really felt like the parties are back on. I got to spend a lot of time with friends to make some new friends at these parties. I had breakfast yesterday with my brother and a cousin. And so it was really a good holiday season for me. And I just hung up some, I don't know if you can see them, Dalmatian stuff on my mantelpiece. And I'm wearing a Dalmatian pin today. So I'm feeling really, really holiday spirit.
You know, one of my knitting girlfriends gave me a chicken pin and it's so cute. I was afraid my daughter was going to try to steal it from me, but I will again channel my inner Jill Winebanks and wear it next time I'm on TV. So I know our listeners can't see your Dalmatians. They also can't see the gorgeous sage green sweater that Kim is wearing. And it looks fabulous on you. Is that holiday swag? And how has your holiday been?
This is not holiday swag, but it's been a really wonderful holiday season. My stepkids are home, and we had a wonderful time, a big dinner, and exchanged presents. And it was pretty nice, pretty low key, but all very, very good. But you know, Jill, next year I'm going to have to figure out how to get to Chicago so that I can make you my sweet potato latkes, which are outstanding.
Oh my, I want those.
Nice and crispy. So
maybe you can give me a Zoom lesson on how to make them.
Deal.
That would be great. We'll do it together.
Done.
Oh, that would be so much fun, Kim. I want to do that. Yes.
I too will be happy to come to Chicago for that. I will say, you know, I made latkes this year. I do every year. And two innovations that were game changers. One is the secret to making good latkes is you have to get all the moisture out after you shred the potatoes.
Yes.
I did it in a salad spinner. I saw somebody
that's
doing that
so
on Instagram.
Oh, brilliant.
Life changing, you know, no more like 2 hours of squeezing potatoes in cheesecloth.
Yeah. That's why mine have always failed.
Well, I'm telling you, salad spinner, that's the ticket. And then I made them one night for a whole bunch of people. And after a like 2 a.m. in the morning consultation with Dahlia Lithwick, who, you know, I figure knows about these things, I decided that it was perfectly kosher for me to do them on sheet pans in the oven. So I heated up canola oil and then I
splatted my latkes in, and I, in essence, baked them. No yucky oil smell in the
really?
House. They were delicious. I mean, is it a cooking podcast or is it a politics podcast?
We really need to do a cooking.
Well, let's do a cooking one.
It's an eating podcast.
I think
know,
there's
that might
for
be
eaters.
The thing.
I'll share my mother's Kugel recipe with apples. Oh, so good.
Wow. I'm sensing a theme here. Okay. Well, at least now we know the bad news isn't as bad because it comes with good cooking tips.
As I said 3 weeks already, this will be the fourth time I've mentioned it. I really learned something from Valerie Biden Owens when she said, "No one ever asks me for my recipes or who does my hair." I think that's becoming my new motto.
The bipartisan House Ethics Committee report was released on what seems like weeks ago, but was only this Monday. They found substantial evidence that Matt Gaetz, Donald Trump's first pick for attorney general, violated Florida's statutory rape law and engaged in a broader pattern of paying women for sex, and found evidence of illegal drug use, acceptance of improper gifts, granting special favors to persons who were not constituents, and obstruction of the committee's investigation. They found clear violations of House rules and standards of conduct as well. Gaetz denies everything, and there is a dissent, but it's only objecting to the release of the report, not to its conclusions. So Barb, let's get to what its conclusions were. What were the key findings?
Yeah, it's got a nice summary right at the start of the report, and it's pretty scathing. We'll start with the good news for Matt Gaetz. They did not find that the law, the specific federal statute prohibiting sex trafficking, was violated. That's the good news. The bad news is that they did find that Gaetz regularly paid women for engaging in sexual activity with him, that he probably violated Florida's statutory rape law by having sex with a victim who is just called Victim A, but was 17 years old at the time. And, you know, Gaetz, who says this was all about youthful indiscretions, was 35 at the time, old enough to be president of the United States. He used or possessed illegal drugs, including cocaine, marijuana, and ecstasy. He violated the House gift rule by receiving impermissible gifts. He dispensed special privileges and favors to individuals with whom he had a personal relationship. And this was not, constituent services. This was getting an expedited passport for a woman with whom he had a sexual relationship who was not a constituent. And he knowingly and willfully sought to impede and obstruct the committee's investigation. They subpoenaed his testimony. He failed to comply. They asked him for documents. They asked him for records. He said he had evidence that would exonerate him, but he continuously refused to produce it. They said he deflected, deterred, and misled the committee to prevent his actions from being exposed. And finally, he acted in a manner that discredits the House. So those were the findings. And it's, based on witness testimony, and I think it's really important to say, just because this does not amount to a criminal violation, or at least as criminal prosecution was declined by federal prosecutors, does not mean he did not engage in serious misconduct. And they found the standard they used was substantial evidence to support these findings.
And we're going to talk about both those facts, Barb. We're going to talk about the federal and state laws. But before I get to that, Kim, let's talk about the House rules that were violated and what are the consequences of violating House rules?
Well, according to this report, at least two House rules were violated. The clearest violation was for that passport application expedition that Barb mentioned. For a woman he had a relationship with for money, that violated the House rules for using your position for special favors. You're not supposed to do that. That he violated that rule. He also violated a disclosure rule for gifts by taking a lavish trip to the Bahamas which included a private jet. I wonder if a Supreme Court justice was with him. I didn't double check on that. But the trip was so high in value that that also violated House rules. But what are the consequences? Nothing, because he's no longer in the House. The House Ethics Committee has no jurisdiction over him anymore. So violating those rules is absolutely meaningless. It means nothing. One thing that I would love to hear from the prosecutors, though, is, and we're going to talk about Florida law. I am, and I get it. The report says it didn't rise to the level of federal trafficking laws. Where is the District of Columbia? Like, why is not the Metropolitan Police Department arresting him if he did crimes, drug and sex crimes, allegedly in the House in the District of Columbia? I would love to know why D.C. prosecutors aren't looking at him, but maybe
to say nothing of showing on the floor of the House, right? Let's call it pornography. But
yes,
yeah, Joyce, that was my question for you.
I mean, I'm not sure that showing pornography is a crime, but certainly drug dealing is. So, like, if I did that anywhere in this District of Columbia, I don't think that I would just be chilling without an arrest warrant over the holidays.
No, you'd be nominated for Attorney General.
Anyway, Joyce, seriously, that was the question for you, is what about federal, Florida, and D.C. laws? What are implicated here, and why were no criminal charges filed? And does that mean, as Gates has claimed, that he was exonerated?
Yeah. So, look, I mean, there are a lot of laws, both federal and state, that could have at least potentially been implicated by the conduct that the report lays out. And the report, you know, they sort of take it on and suggest what they think the laws are. I think it's probably important to point out that prosecutors, the people who actually have experience charging and prosecuting under these laws, might have some differing ideas. It looks really easy when you're not the person who has to stand up in a courtroom and get a jury to convict based on evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. But I actually think the committee did a pretty good job of assessing what the statutory ambit is like in this case. In the federal system, there are at least two statutes that could have come into play that apply to sex trafficking. There's a provision that makes it illegal to traffic, which is defined as including recruiting or enticing or transporting a minor for paid for sex. And to convict, prosecutors have to be able to convince the jury beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant knew, or at least that they stuck their head in the sand to avoid learning, that the victim was a minor. And then there's a second statute called the Mann Act. It used to be widely used to prosecute prostitution. The classic case was a man who took a woman across state lines in order to have sex with her. That provision isn't used as frequently these days. It's often reserved for focusing on particularly serious types of sex trafficking, especially involving minors. But suffice it to say, federal prosecutors had statutes that they undoubtedly took a look at. And we know that they did, because there are reports that the Middle District of Florida U.S. Attorney's Office evaluated this evidence and decided not to prosecute. So what about state prosecution? Florida has statutes that prohibit sex with minors, possession of drugs, all findings in the report. And the statutory rape law in Florida specifically provides that a defendant's failure to know that his victim is under the age of majority is not a defense. So it's a little bit more pro-prosecution friendly than federal law is. You know, cocaine and ecstasy are both controlled substances in Florida and in the District of Columbia, as far as I know, and people are routinely prosecuted for possessing them. And then the report has one interesting final suggestion about a law that Gates might have violated, and that's a witness tampering statute. They suggest that potentially he tampered with witnesses in the congressional investigation. So how come with all of this outlay of crime, there was never an indictment? You know, the simple answer for the federal case is that federal prosecutors did not believe they had sufficient evidence to obtain and sustain a conviction. We don't know why. There are some possibilities. Perhaps they believed that the conduct that was chargeable was outside of the 5-year statute of limitations. Most of this conduct happens in 2017. The timing is tight on the investigation. Or maybe they think that Gates could have established that he could not have reasonably known that his victim was under 18. There was some indication that an effort was made to keep that information from him so he wouldn't be the guy who stuck his head in the sand to avoid knowing. And prosecutors could have also made an assessment that their witnesses would not have held up in front of a jury and that a jury might not have convicted. You know, that burden of proof prosecutors have is proof beyond reasonable doubt of a defendant's guilt. That's a much higher standard than what Barb was articulating applies to an ethics investigation in the House. So we don't know why state authorities would have passed on the other charges. That's sort of a big question mark. And it's also interesting, you know, this new allegation of witness tampering during the House investigation is something that federal prosecutors in the Middle District of Florida would not have taken into account when they were investigating their case because it came later on in time. I'm old enough to remember when people were prosecuted for ignoring congressional subpoenas. Steve Bannon went to federal prison, as did Peter Navarro. But I'm not optimistic that a Trump Justice Department will give this much of a hard look.
So, Joyce, I'm old enough to remember when the Mann Act was used by the federal government, oftentimes as part of organized crime stuff.
Yeah,
oh,
absolutely.
I'm so glad to hear that. Okay, so there was a dissent, which, as I noted before, agreed with the fact-finding conclusion. It just objected to public disclosure of the report. Why? It has been done in the past when someone is no longer in Congress that it's disclosed. What are the rules and arguments? Do you think this is a time for publication right now in these circumstances? Let me start with you, Barb.
Yeah, I see the point. You know, there is this view of the chairman on behalf of the dissenting committee members who say, we don't challenge any of the findings, but we do take exception that the majority has deviated from the committee's well-established standards to release the report. And then they say this action has not been done by a committee since 2006. Well, it has been done then. I think, you know, they have a point. I do think that there is value in following norms and practices, regardless of which side benefits from it. You know, I think back to James Comey saying terrible things about Hillary Clinton, even though no charges were brought, which was a real violation of norms. But here, I think the one reason I might disagree with that is that the only reason that they were stripped of jurisdiction is because Gates himself kind of orchestrated it, right? He gets nominated for attorney general 2 days before this report is to come out. And then he immediately resigns his seat in Congress, I think in a deliberate effort to thwart this report from being disclosed to the public. And then, you know, ultimately he withdraws. I still am not sure that that whole nomination of Gates wasn't just an effort to help him get out from under this investigation, you know, and then he could go forward and do whatever it is he wants to do, including, I still think there's a risk that he goes back into Congress. And so I don't have a problem with this. I think that the public is entitled to this. I'm a big fan of transparency in general. And the only reason we have that rule is because it's a House rule, which can be changed at any time. And they created that rule to protect themselves. And so I think if there's misconduct by members of Congress, even if they are recently former members of Congress, transparency is a value that we should assert here.
Yeah, I think that is really... Oh, go ahead, Kim. Go ahead.
I agree with Barb, not only on the unclean hands point, which is very important. Like, you know, this was Gates trying to be cute. But also just the severity of this. This isn't just violation of House rules and now this is a former member and that matter is put to close. This is the allegation of the commission of very, very serious crimes. Crimes that are not nonviolent. I think someone's just like, oh, you know, he wouldn't go to jail for nonviolent. This feels pretty violent to me when you're talking about what took place here. And I think the seriousness of it would... You would think that it would be a bipartisan value to disclose something when somebody who was given a position of public trust by his constituents behaved in this way. People certainly have the right to know about it.
I agree with you on the transparency, but I also, I mean, Barb, you mentioned this, is that when he was resigning from the current Congress. He had already been elected to the next Congress. And although he said, I will not take the oath in the second Congress, and although since then an election has been set up to elect a replacement for him for the next Congress, he could go back into public service. And so when you combine the requirement of transparency, this was a publicly funded investigation. It was a bipartisan investigation. I think there's just no question that this was the appropriate time for revealing the information so that anyone voting in the future would know what was going on. What about you, Joyce? You in on this?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think the public has a right to know. There was the looming attorney general nomination. There was the fact that both Barb and Kim have focused on that he was unrecalcitrant. And I think the fact that Gates ultimately touted this as an exoneration of him meant that this report had to be released. And it's not unprecedented. There's nothing inappropriate or wrong about doing it. It's used in limited cases. Well, baby, this is the poster child for that.
That's for sure. And there were four prior examples of release after someone left Congress. So, Kim, you and I have done defense work. What do you think about his defense? He said, I was charged with nothing. I was fully exonerated. And I was, you know, I was wild in my youth, even though he was 35 at the time.
He's acting like this happened 30 years ago. Like, no, first of all, this is a very Trumpian response, fully exonerated in all caps. I mean, it's basically was Trump standing next to him and took his phone and wrote this himself. It's really what it sounded like. But one thing that I do think in all seriousness, because this didn't happen very long ago, like, Florida, what are y'all doing with the statute of limitations on statutory rape charge? I mean, that's ridiculous. That's really, really short. This is not a situation where it was 30 years ago. Memories have faded. He said, she said, a lack of actual evidence. This happened while he was a member of Congress and he hadn't been there for very long. So that's really outrageous. How the District of Columbia laws don't read this, just, I think, is really outrageous. And it's really sad that someone can be alleged to have done this kind of behavior and seems to be walking away. So in a sense, he's not lying because he's fully exonerated in that there probably won't be any consequences. But this is really serious stuff, and it should really give people pause about whatever kind of public life he has from here on in.
So I hate to disagree, but you are not exonerated because you weren't charged. That doesn't mean you're innocent.
I'm not disagreeing. I'm saying, in effect, what he's saying is, if he means I'm exonerated, I got off scot-free, he's not wrong. Like, this, it looks like an exoneration. It's just as good as an exoneration because there's no accountability. I'm not saying that he's correct. Okay. I'm saying that this is the outcome.
It's just a matter of semantics, whether exoneration is this. Even not guilty doesn't mean you're innocent. It means that the prosecution didn't prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. Doesn't mean you didn't do it.
I have a question for each of you. I hope your family showered you with gifts this holiday season. You all deserve that. But have you ever had a friend who was so generous that they took you on a cruise on their super yacht to New Zealand? Anybody have friends like that?
No,
I've never even laid eyeballs on a super yacht. Like, I don't think I've actually...
Yeah,
it's
called the Michaela Rose, and it is Harlan Crowe's super yacht. Well, the Senate Judiciary Committee majority staff issued a report this week with its findings about ethics and the Supreme Court. That's, what do you call that, an oxymoron when you've got two things in this that don't jibe? Ethics in the Supreme Court, and guess which justice, it turned out, had even more undisclosed gifts. Anybody have a guess for me?
Give me a hint. let me see.
It rhymes with parents pomace.
Ah, I see. I suspected as such.
Yeah. So they did this 2-year investigation and issued a report this week. So Joyce, can you tell us about the committee's investigation and report? There's some interesting little tidbits in there.
Yeah, so this is a 20-month investigation into ethics in the federal judiciary, speaking of oxymorons. And it came on the heels of the disclosure by ProPublica and others of these really serious conflict of interest issues that we discussed extensively and that really rocked public confidence, including mine, in the judiciary. I mean, I remember week after week where Kim and I were out on the ledge together, right? And then came the Supreme Court's decision in, Trump versus USA, the presidential immunity case. I mean, these are not contextless quibbles with ethics. These are serious problems. And the Senate Judiciary Committee was correct to press forward. Unfortunately, the report that was issued by Democratic staff members of the Judiciary Committee. And they released this really lengthy report, 800 pages of documents that were attached. Some of the tidbits that stuck out for me were the fact that Harlan Crowe, you may remember, super friend of Clarence Thomas, was able to duck the subpoena process by engaging in what he characterized as voluntary compliance, but he denounced the inquiry in these words. He called it political, partisan, and unconstitutional from the start. You know, you would think Republicans in Congress would have been defending their process, but they did not. But Leonard Leo, one of the conservative legal activists behind the work of the Federalist Society, completely refused to comply with the subpoena. One of the guys who had funded one of the Alito trips. And again, this is another case where I'm forced to toss my hands up in the air and say I'm old enough to remember when people were prosecuted for ignoring congressional subpoenas. That's what Leonard Leo seems to have done here. He does not seem to be concerned that he will get in any trouble, which is perhaps a comment on the era that we live in.
And he's not just a funder of some of these lavish trips or organizer of it. Leonard Leo is the architect of the rightward shift of the entire federal judiciary. So it is rich. It is rich that the very committee that is tasked with giving advice and consent on judicial nominees, he's just going to flout and say, I don't answer to you, when he has used that committee to the advantage of conservatives for the last 2 decades. I mean, the gall.
Yeah. And maybe they just ran out of time, but I have to say I'm kind of offended that they didn't follow up and try to enforce this subpoena. I mean, Steve Bannon got prosecuted and convicted for blowing off a subpoena. I mean, why not Leonard Leo? I think, he's sometimes when you've got, say, a separation of powers issue, right? There's a subpoena for someone in the executive branch or prosecutor, and they try to work through that whole accommodation and negotiation process because of a separation of powers. Leonard Leo is just a private actor.
Private citizen. What
do you mean it's political? You're the one who's made it political. Oh, that one's frustrating. Well, Kim, let's get to the juicy stuff, because as we said, guess whose name came up again as someone with even more undisclosed gifts, with this guy, Harlan Crowe, who did not know Clarence Thomas until after he was a Supreme Court justice. So this idea of my dear friend, which is always code for, my corrupt associate, giving him all these lavish gifts. What about that? What's new here?
Yeah. So on top of the more than 24 trips that have been taken overall, there were two that had not previously been disclosed. Clarence Thomas was apparently treated to a private jet flight to New York's Adirondacks in July, as well as a jet and yacht trip to New York City. I get on the train. Like, I don't know about y'all, but it's not that far from D.C. where the justice hangs out to New York City. But there was a jet and a yacht involved in this trip, both care of Harlan Crowe, and that happened in October. It's actually funny. Right before this report dropped, there was an Onion article, which is satire, y'all, for y'all who don't know, but it said something like Clarence Thomas has a tough time deciding between which lavish trip to take in this case on which side. And then this report literally dropped and it's like, it's impossible to tell satire from real life anymore. It's too much.
Yeah, there's one description in there that he was on a flight on a plane that had the Miami Dolphins logo etched on the tail. And it was unclear whether the gift had come from Wayne Huizenga, the owner of the Miami Dolphins at the time, or the team itself. But, you know, like, who's flying around in jets with the, you know, the Miami Dolphins logo on it? My gosh. Humble public servants. Yeah. You know, and Kim, you've pointed this out many times. It's not even problematic for them to take these trips, though I would submit, like, just don't take free stuff. You've got this incredibly important job. They include in the report the salaries of these justices, which is what now? Close to $200,000 a year, far more than, you know, the median income of people living in Washington, D.C., or even people working in government. And yet they take all this free stuff. Like, you've got the privilege of a lifetime to be a Supreme Court justice. Just don't take the free stuff. But even that is not the problem. It's just the failure to disclose the free stuff. So the committee has some proposals for solutions. Jill, let me ask you about those. Do you like any of these solutions? You know, the court is always saying, oh, it would be a violation of the separation of powers for Congress to propose any solutions for us.
I am appalled by the whole situation. It is why the Supreme Court is held in such low esteem, why no one trusts them anymore, why you see constant references to the corruption there. I mean, it's really sad. And yes, the report does include some references to possible solutions. None of them is adequate. So let's start with that. There are several bills that have been proposed. One is the Supreme Court Ethics Recusal and Transparency Act, and it has gone nowhere and is probably going to go even less anywhere once the new Congress takes over. And there were several bills before that. Senator Murphy, Senators King and Murkowski had proposed some, and those would have required that the Supreme Court itself pass a code of conduct. And as we can all remember, the pressure from the public disclosures, from the ProPublica report and everything, did lead to them sort of doing that. And we talked about it on one of our shows before, where it isn't enforceable. It didn't include that someone would investigate from the outside. It was still up to them. And they could recuse or not recuse if they felt like it or if they didn't feel like it. And they didn't have to say why they did or didn't recuse. And there was no way for anyone to file a complaint and an outside party to investigate. And although the act sort of, I mean, if you invert the combined letters, it's sort of like the Secret Act or the Secret Act. I don't know how you pronounce those weird letters. It doesn't really do all that much. It does require some level of disclosure, which I don't think is enough, because I think, like you, Barb, they shouldn't be taking this. Why should they take anything? Any other federal employee, even at low levels, and any other judge in the federal system cannot take gifts over a certain level, which definitely doesn't include the level at which these gifts were. And let's not forget, Justice Thomas had his nephew's private school tuition paid, his mother's house mortgage paid off. I mean, there's a lot going on besides these trips.
I just wanted to interject. And his $267,000 RV, for which he received a loan from Harlan Crow that was forgiven.
Yes. I mean, the level of corruption for Justice Thomas, and don't forget about his wife's income for things that should have led to his recusal. And I mean, he is the poster boy for why we need Supreme Court ethics imposed on the court. And I believe that there is grounds for Congress to intervene, but I also think it's really a downright crime that the Supreme Court itself hasn't seen fit to do this. Shame on them.
The
President Biden had a very busy holiday season. He signed dozens of bills into law before heading off to holiday vacation with his family. But one bill he did not sign made some waves and attracted some heat. It's called the Judges Act, and it would have added more trial level judges to the federal judiciary. So before we get to this veto that he did, Barb, what would this law have done? And just sort of explain this. It was a rare bipartisan bill that made it to Joe Biden's desk.
Yeah, you know, this was something that Democrats and Republicans worked on. Both liked it. It would add, I think, something like 63 judgeships to districts around the country that, based on a study by the Judicial Conference itself, this is part of the judiciary, said where there were backlogs, you know, California, Texas, places where, you know, we've seen population shifts in recent years. And so, you know, the dockets are really crowded. But importantly, in an effort to make sure that no one party got a majority of these seats or, you know, fill them all immediately, they would be staggered over the next 10 years. So every 2 years, the president would get to appoint like 10 of them. And in that way, it would prevent either Republicans or Democrats from filling all the slots. So it seemed like a really good way to go about filling creating new judgeships in a bipartisan way that would offset this backlog.
So, Jill, as we said, President Biden vetoed this this legislation. What was his reason for vetoing it? And what do you think about his reason?
So I'll tell you what his reason as stated was, and that is what he said in his message to the Senate about why he was vetoing. He said that it was hastily done and that it would give an opportunity that he wasn't sure was really needed, that it didn't take into consideration how the existence of senior judges in different districts or magistrates in different districts would affect the caseload of those districts. Although the answer to that from all of its supporters, all of the Act supporters, is that none of that is true, that it was not hastily done. And he also said that the allocation wasn't clear, even though it clearly said that it would be done in three tranches, one for the next president, one for the president after that, and one for the president after that. So at least two different presidents would be involved, and that's assuming that the president after Trump's second term is reelected, and then it would only be two, but it would still be three presidencies that would be involved in doing this. I think everyone widely agrees that there is a backload of cases that needs to be fixed. I think what's important to say is that he didn't talk about the fact that this was a bipartisan bill that had factual support and that people really think we need extra judges. And so it's unclear to me why he really did the veto. It just doesn't always make sense to me.
So Joyce, what do you think? I mean, this isn't, and just to be clear to our listeners, this isn't a packing the court kind of plan. These are all trial level judges that handle cases. And as we pointed out earlier, there are some places where just the population has boomed since the number of judges were set. And so it leads to backlogs in processing cases in those places. And that could lead to a delay of justice. So this was bipartisan. They tried to do it. Any sort of judicial reform is better when done over time so that everybody gets a shot at making some of these appointments. Joyce, what do you think about it?
Yeah, so, my sweet summer children, there's nothing going on here that's bipartisan or innocent or not political in nature. And maybe this one hits a little bit close to home for me, because at the end of the Obama administration, Barb and I had a number of friends, really qualified people who had been nominated for federal judgeships who were left hanging, who didn't get confirmed. At the end of that administration, there were 105 open seats, including one on the Supreme Court, and they were blocked by Republicans. those were 105 existing seats, right? Not new ones. Those were 105 empty seats. And you'd think Republicans would have been demanding that they be filled, given the need that they now see for just additional judgeships. But no, they were fine with blocking them. At the time, I talked with a Court of Appeals judge who was appointed by a Republican president, and he told me that there was no need to fill them because the district judges in the courthouse he worked in weren't really that busy, that they came in after he came in and that they left earlier. And look, that's years ago, but the judicial caseload numbers don't suggest that leaving 100 seats open back then would be so completely meritless that we would need these new judgeships going forward. So fast forward to today. Here's what happens. Suddenly, after Trump wins, Republicans develop enthusiasm for passing this bill. It had been in the works. It would not have passed had Trump not won. It's about politics. Could we use more judges? Arguably, we can in some districts, but that's not what this is about. This is about creating slots that Trump can fill, and we don't need that. And I think Joe Biden did the right thing here. In his statement that he wrote when he returned the bill, by the way, back to Congress, he said, S-4199 would create new judgeships in states where senators have sought to hold open existing judicial vacancies. Those efforts to hold open vacancies suggest the concerns about judicial economy and caseload are not the true motivating force behind passage of this bill now. And so to come full circle, Republicans were happy to hold those seats open when Obama was in office. They were happy to hold them open while Biden was in office. That means that their claim that these seats are so essential really should fall on deaf ears. I'm a fan of what the president did here.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree only because, and I take your point. Everything that you said is correct about the obstruction that Republicans have openly done in an effort to shift the judiciary rightward with Leonard Leo and all the other deep-pocketed folks in conservative circles that have done that. It's absolutely shameful. We saw that example with Merrick Garland, his appointment to the Supreme Court, and more. Totally agree with all of that. But I believe that this is an important piece of legislation on its own. It is something that should get bipartisan support. We should have a government that works for us. And the fact that this is otherwise a piece of legislation that Joe Biden backed, that he pushed for when he was on the Senate Judiciary Committee, but for the timing now, that if politics are the only reason he's vetoing it, he's not just sticking it to Republicans. He's really making our judicial system, in my opinion, less efficient. And it's a price that the Republicans really won't bear. It's the people who are in the civil and criminal justice systems who will. So I think, especially since it is a bit Trump-proof, yes, Trump would give some of the appointments, but presidents after him, assuming he ever leaves, will also get them. This is what it should be like. I'm not so sure, Jill, that it just means that it's going to get passed President Trump will sign it. I don't think that there is a filibuster-proof majority, and I think the Democrats will probably try to block it. And so then where are we going to get the politics? Unless you have one party with 60% of the Senate and both houses, you're not going to get any judicial reform done. So I just think that that's just the government working.
Let me put one last gloss on my argument, Kim, since you don't love my argument. And I think
your argument. No, I just disagree.
I think your points are well taken. But but what I want to say is this. The Senate is different than it was when Joe Biden supported this sort of legislation when he was on judiciary. And what changed was the Republicans' discovery during the Obama administration that they could engage in obstruction and refuse to confirm nominees. It was very unprecedented the way they did it. They weren't lodging objections to these nominees. They were just refusing to confirm them because they were going to be appointed by a Democrat. That was new. Democrats did some of that during the Trump administration, but you may recall we all talked about a lot of judges who were blocked for good reasons, like that guy in Montgomery, Alabama, who was into paranormal romance. There were like some crazy ass, potential nominees, right, who were blocked. And by and large, Republicans were permitted to fill seats. including a vacancy on the Supreme Court, after Donald Trump lost the election, right? Or Aileen Cannon, who was confirmed after Donald Trump lost the election. So I think that this fear that Democrats and that the president has is legitimate. Donald Trump gets his tranche of 25 under this bill. I think the concern is Democrats would never get theirs. And while Jill may be right that the bill ultimately does pass in some way, shape, or form, I think the important thing is to say, despite legitimate concerns about the judiciary, this is not normal politics. This is more of Leonard Leo et al. At work trying to reform the judiciary into a Republican-owned enterprise, top to bottom, and it is deeply troubling.
It is definitely troubling, and we have to look at how many vacancies there are right now, because that does support Biden's statement in rejecting this bill and vetoing it, that it isn't being done because there is an overload of cases. Because if that was the reason, then all the judges that are pending now would have been approved. And a lot have been. I believe that President Biden has managed to have confirmed more judges than most presidents in the past, including Donald Trump in his first term.
Yeah, so
they are getting approved. But because there is a caseload problem, there should be more approved, and there should be none pending right now. All of the judges that are vacant now should have been done. And I can see why President Biden would take that as a point of pride to say, I'm not letting you get 25 more than you already have because of the ones that are pending. Fill those first, and then we'll see if we have a need. If those aren't vacant, then maybe we won't have the same need. You have to evaluate it after all of those are filled, and you already have a plethora of judges to fill. So I do get that point, and I think that's the most significant thing that he said in his veto message.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair and to give y'all's argument the credibility it deserves, you never know. These numbers fluctuate because Biden has had success confirming judges, but there are roughly 36 vacancies right now. There are about 890 federal judges. Not all of them are Article III judges subject to confirmation, but that gives you some idea of the landscape. So Biden is not sitting where Barack Obama was at this point. And some of those open judgeships are, quite frankly, Joe Biden's own fault because he honors the blue seat. Yeah. And there are some vacancies where he has not made nominations because Republican senators have not signed off on those nominees. But I think that sort of proves the point of Republican obstruction. I mean, it's really interesting. How do you make sure that the courts can function and people can get justice when one party doesn't want to play by the rules? So now it's time for our favorite part of the podcast, where we get to answer your questions. It may be the holidays, but you guys did not go easy on us this week at all, and we have lots of really great questions to choose from. If you do have a question for us as we head into the new year, please email us at sistersinlaw@politicon.com or tag us on social media using #sistersinlaw. If we don't get to your question during the show, keep an eye on our feeds throughout the week. We're on Threads, Blue Sky, and maybe a little bit still on Twitter. We'll answer as many of your questions as we can. Jill, let me start with you this week because we had a lot of similar questions. I'm going to read one that came from Lori, but a lot of people are interested, and I think you have the right experience to answer. So if Elon Musk becomes Speaker of the House, perish the thought, would he still be third in line for the presidency? This is that weird, obscure provision that lets someone who's not a member of the House be the speaker. Please give us some insight. And if you can keep Kim and me off the ledge on this one, we'd appreciate it.
I think I can, because it's a really interesting question, because it is weird that someone who's not even a member of Congress, not even a former member of Congress, could be the Speaker of the House, which is a very, very powerful position. But that is the way the rules work. But the Constitution does require that to be president, you have to be a natural-born citizen. And don't get me started on birthright citizenship. But Elon Musk is not a natural-born citizen, so he cannot become president of the United States, even if he is the speaker and would be in the line of succession. It would have to skip him. So no, we don't have to worry about him becoming president. Elon Musk could be the Speaker of the House, and it's not looking like there's anyone who's fighting Mike Johnson to be speaker, so he may win anyway. But that remains to be seen on January 3rd, but it will not ever make Elon Musk in line to be president of the United States.
Okay, well, that's one thing to cross off the list of potential bad stuff. So thank you, Jill.
You don't have to worry about that anymore.
I mean, that's the right spot in the day. Hey, Barb, Kim in Minnetonka, Minnesota has a question. This is a great question, too. Given that the incoming president has promised to pardon the January 6th insurrectionists, I saw one statement where Trump said it might happen in the first minutes of his presidency. Can the officers, the Capitol Police, who were injured, sue them for the pain and suffering they've endured? Civil suit, maybe?
Yes. And I am very pleased to hear from someone, Kim, in Minnetonka, Minnesota, which I believe is the hometown of the Tonka truck. So Minnetonka, a very cool place.
I thought it was where moccasins came from. Those Minnetonka moccasins, they're great.
Maybe that too. You know what?
Isn't that the place where Prince told Apollonia to purify herself in the waters of Lake Minnetonka?
All right, we are doing a live show in Minnetonka. We just have to do this.
There is something for everyone.
Purple
in
Rain fans, Purple please Rain, tell
absolutely.
Me.
I like the trucks. Well, Kim, thank you for your question. Yes, absolutely. Yes. You know, there already are pending a number of civil lawsuits against Donald Trump for their injuries and property damage that was incurred on January 6th. You know, millions of dollars in damage at the Capitol, personal injuries. So police officers and members of Congress have filed civil lawsuits against Trump. In the short amount of time I was stalling about Tonka trucks, I was Googling to see if there are other civil cases filed against other individuals. And all I can find on the Google machine is cases filed against Donald Trump. But there'd be nothing to prevent somebody from filing, you know, if say, somebody who engaged in hand-to-hand combat and harmed a police officer, killed a police officer, there was the officer who died the next day from his injuries with bear spray, could absolutely file a civil lawsuit. My guess is there already are some pending. I just wasn't able to find them. But even if there is a criminal case, there can still be a parallel civil case, because civil cases, of course, are for money damages as opposed to a criminal case, which is for punishment through prison, fines, or otherwise.
So interesting, and there's a great question for follow-up for you, Kim, since you're our experienced civil litigator. This one comes from Toby in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, and Toby wants to know, if a lawsuit is dismissed or withdrawn, who pays the legal fees for the person who was accused? I'm assuming that question is in the civil context, right? Yep. And that they're saying accused in the sense of the defendant who the plaintiff lawsuit. Brought civil charges against.
Yes. I'm taking that and lawsuit to mean that in the civil context. This is a great question. Generally speaking, under what is known as the American rule, each side is expected to pay their own legal fees. So that's sort of the default position when there is any litigation throughout. Each party pays their own fees. But there are times that either a court or the law itself provides for a shifting of legal fees. So for example, if someone files a frivolous lawsuit, one without any merit at all, a court can find that in dismissing that the person who filed that suit be responsible for all the legal fees. And keep in mind, that's not just to pay for attorneys, it's also the expenses, court filings, things like that. If there were expert witnesses that needed to be called in the discovery, it can be really expensive. And there are also sometimes in a statute under which you bring a lawsuit, it provides that the winner will get awarded attorney's fees. So I did a lot of consumer protection litigation when I was a civil attorney, and the the consumer protection statutes often provided explicitly if there was a finding of a violation of that law that the fees would be picked up by the defendant in that case. But that's a great question.
Well, good questions. I hope you guys will send us more for this coming couple of shows, because we know that we are headed into sort of uncharted waters. Can I say that instead of unprecedented, right? We all got sick of the word unprecedented.
Well done.
We'll go with uncharted for now. But thank you for listening to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Barb McQuaid, Kimberly Atkins-Store, Jill Winebanks, and me, Joyce Vance. Follow Hashtag Sisters-in-Law on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And please give us a 5-star review. It really helps others find the show. Please show some love to this week's sponsors, Thrive Cosmetics, Lola V, and Calm. Their links are in the show notes. Your support for them really helps us because they help make the podcast possible. See you next week with another episode, Hashtag Sisters-in-Law.
I want you all to know I just looked up Minnetonka. It's near Minnesota, so it's a place we could go. Moccasins are from there. Cargill, the largest privately held company, is there. Prince is from there.
Yes.
And the truck, Tonka Trunk, is from Mound, Minnesota, not Minnetonka.
Ooh, no. Are you going to purify yourselves in the waters of Lake Minnetonka?
Absolutely. I'm a huge Purple Rain fan. In fact, Bob and me on our first date, it was a law school formal dance, and we then went back to a friend's apartment and we all watched Purple Rain.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's one of the greatest movies of all time.